So, what's the right attitude to have for prayer? And why would we start a sermon series by answering that question? We might be surprised to learn that our attitude in prayer may not only affect our present relationship with God, but our future relationship as well. Our attitudes in prayer can reveal the good, the bad, and the ugly. Welcome to the Cinco de Mayo version of the Community Group Leader's Preparation Guide. We are in the home stretch, folks. Can you believe there's only three sessions left? You know what that means, of course. End of Course Critiques will be coming out next week, so I encourage you to start thinking about what you would like to hear in terms of feedback, and let me know. I can add that to the questions. Also, prepare your people to begin reflecting what the session has been like for them, and get them thinking about what improvements we might make to help this make a big difference in their faith life. Also wanted to let everyone know that we are working on a separate blog that will link to our website. It's called lifeisdifferent.org. We have determined that that would be the best way to get all these wonderful stories that we're hearing out, whether it be just a simple text entry, videos, photography, all kinds of things. We're going to have a better outlet to get the stories out there. But we can only get better stories out there if we know about them. So please continue to relay those stories, no matter how insignificant they may seem. We will have a venue to tell those stories. And in telling stories, we provide encouragement, we provide opportunity for people to see what we're all about, and it becomes very attractional, very compelling for them, so that maybe they will want what faith we have. They will want to know more about Jesus, and that is the ultimate goal. So keep the stories coming. Encourage your storytellers to capture details and send them our way. And we will get a blog up and running where we can tell those stories on a regular basis. All right, jumping into today's lesson. If you have the Community Group Leader's Guide with you, great. If not, we'll just talk through some of the major topics. Our main objective here is we're setting the stage for a 7-part sermon series. That's right, you heard, 7-part sermon series on prayer. Now, this sermon series is going to run longer than our groups will. Our groups only have 3 sessions left, so we're going to cut out right in the middle of a series. It might be worth considering in your group how you all want to stay in touch over the summer. If people have questions as the sermon series goes on, or if you want to just leave it informal where we'll chat on the phone or on Sundays, or do we want to continue to meet in smaller groups or something like that. No requirement, no expectation on my part. Just pointing out that the sermon series will last longer than the group. So if there are questions, might be an opportunity for you to reach out and make contact outside of the normal channels. All right, the big 3 in the lesson today. We have a parable told by Jesus, the Pharisee and the tax collector that we'll look at. We have this idea called justification. What does it mean? Why is it important? And then we have the idea of what's the proper attitude for prayer. Let's jump into those real quick. First of all, the Pharisee and the tax collector. One of the things that we see here is obviously a huge difference in how these two individuals approach prayer. But don't let the group just name differences. The question asks them to compare and contrast and look for similarities and differences. They will jump right on the differences right away because they're so glaringly obvious. But think about the similarities for just a second and why the similarities might be important. Both of these people made an effort to go to the temple. Both of these people made an effort to pray to God. And so why would we focus on other similarities? Well, in looking at the similarities, we might see some things that can help us to not become the Pharisee in our prayer life. And many of us start out in our prayer life like the tax collector. We know that we need help. We know that God can help us, and so we cry out. But it seems that the further we go along our Christian walk, if we're not careful, our prayers can become more like that Pharisee. So take the time, look at some of the similarities in these guys, and see if there are any similarities to our lives. We'll take that back up again in the taking it home section a little bit later. Just to break down a little bit of what the differences are, you'll notice that when the Pharisee prays, he's focusing on what he does, or better yet, what he doesn't do. And when he does that, he's focusing on the law, which most Pharisees would. But what you notice is that what he doesn't do is a comparison to other people. And we can feel pretty good when we compare ourselves to other people because we can always find someone who's a little less holy than we are. So notice what the Pharisee does. He takes his focus off of God. He takes his focus onto the law, but only selectively, only parts of the law, because he's only looking at the parts of the law that he does better than someone else. He's comparing himself to others. He makes himself feel good, but in the end, it really doesn't help him, because as the parable tells us, only one of these two leaves justified before God that day. And I'll give you a hint, it's not the Pharisee. So, as he begins to compare, he compares law selectively, and he applies it to other people who are worse off than he is in his mind, so that he feels better. Now compare that to the tax collector. Notice as the tax collector is not focusing on the law, he's not focusing on do's and don'ts, what he doesn't do. He's focusing on what he is. He is a sinner, and he is talking to the one that can set him free from what he is. So at the end of the day, it's the tax collector, not who focuses on what he does, but on what he is, that leaves justified at the end of the day. Some more there, but I'll let that sink in for just a little bit. Should be a great opportunity for some discussion to see what the difference is in what we do and what we are. The point of all these parables, really, the point of any parable, is to leave you with a question that you have to solve. That's part of Jesus' teaching genius. He doesn't give you the answer. He just poses a question in a scenario that you can relate to, and then he leaves it and lets your mind solve it. So you can anticipate a little bit of frustration. But one thing to consider, what do these guys' lives look like 10 years down the road? If you ever thought, the parable doesn't tell us, the text doesn't say it, and it says, you know, it's not part of the objective, but I just can't help but wonder, what do these guys look like 10 years down the road? The Pharisee, who's been striving to do the right thing and comparing himself to others so he can feel good, is going to have a long track record of comparisonitis. He might be stressed, he might be burned out, he definitely won't be fulfilled, and he definitely will not be justified before God. But on the other hand, 10 years down the road, this senator who is justified, he'll have a sense of freedom. He'll have a sense of being a new person, not just changed behavior, but a new person from the inside out. We know that many of the tax collectors that hung around Jesus, because that's who Jesus hung around, had changed lives. They really repented. They changed their ways. They, in some cases, gave up their profession, or in some cases, actually did their profession honestly, did a job that needed to be done, but did it honestly. And in the process, gained a tremendous sense of freedom, and according to the parable, at least this one, got justified before God. Now that might blow your mind for just a second to think who our spiritual forefathers are, not the holy ones who obey the rules, but the tax collectors who admit that they're sinners. That's who our spiritual forefathers are in some cases. Kind of blows my mind to think about that. But anyway, that should be a good discussion between the similarities and differences. Don't let them pass by the similarities, though. All right, the next item in the lesson is this idea of justification. And let me just warn you, before we get too far deep into this idea of justification, that there have been entire volumes written on this, and it is not my intent to cover every aspect and every detail. My intent here is just to touch on it briefly as a term that needs to be defined because it applies to this parable. We can do a greater study of it some other time, or if you still have questions, by all means, let me know. But this idea of justification, I think the easiest way I've heard to define it would be if you were in a court of law, justification would be the point at which you were declared not guilty. And in terms of this relationship with God, this would be the point at which we are made right with God. Now, this provides another opportunity as a guide or a host to help people understand that they can learn to feed themselves, in this case, with the use of a Bible dictionary, or encourage them to go online to the community group Scoop and take a look at the link there, because it will link them to an electronic Bible dictionary. These are all tools that we want to put in people's hands so that as they go into the summer months and they don't have the group meeting anymore, they can continue to go a little bit deeper and strengthen their faith and their knowledge and hopefully apply some of these things into their Christian walk. So Yeah, we want to get across the idea of justification, but we also want to offer them an opportunity to expand their repertoire of skills in Bible study by the use of a Bible dictionary. There are also several good ones out for that you can purchase, but I don't know that that's really necessary. There are so many online resources these days that that's probably not required. At any rate, we're back to this definition idea of being declared not guilty in this court of law. Why is this concept of justification even important? Why do we stop for a second in this lesson with this great story and go, okay, what is this? Well, if it's the point at which we're declared not guilty, it's important because if we're not justified, then we're still guilty. Nobody wants that. So we need to understand what it is, and we need to understand how we become justified. The easiest one, the most simple and compact one, comes out of Paul's writings where he talks about we are justified by grace through faith. That is the simplest definition, but it's a little more complex. We're justified by grace, which means that Jesus died on the cross. It was a gift from God. It's nothing that we've done, so we can't boast about it. That's the grace part. But it does require some response on our part. If grace were enough by itself, then everybody would go to heaven. Think about that for a second. If grace was all that was required, everyone would end up in heaven. So what that says is, well, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son and everyone would go to heaven. But that's not what the verse says. It says, God so loved the world that whosoever believes in him will have eternal life. That's the faith part. That's our response to the grace. So when we believe, we have faith. That's the final part of that formula. We've been extended grace. We believe through faith. We are justified. You can also see some other clues in the lesson guide I put in there as you read through Romans 5, 1 through 11. But by far, the Ephesians passage is the most succinct and short definition of justification that I found. All right, if you still have questions about that, feel free to call or email or catch me on Sunday. Again, the major emphasis of this lesson is not justification itself. It's just an important point to understand so that as we approach this idea of prayer, and more importantly, this next concept of attitude in prayer, that we understand what role justification plays, what role grace and faith play. All right, next topic is the attitude in prayer. Basically, what we're trying to get at here is that we're always going to be balancing attention, not attention as in paying attention, a tension as in trying to balance two things stretched across. On the one side, we have to be adequately humble in prayer. We're talking to a holy God. On the other side, though, we also have to not continually beat ourselves up or feel like we're not worth anything. I see so many people that take that to the extreme. Either the one extreme might be that they're so arrogant that they don't think they need God, but the other extreme is they feel so unworthy that their self-worth begins to suffer and they get this complex. I don't think that's the abundant life that Jesus calls us to. So how do we hold those two in tension? How do we balance them? Well, we have one clue in this parable that's told between the Pharisee and the tax collectors. If we are comparing ourselves to others, that's going to lead to that arrogance. But when we compare ourselves to God, that's always going to result in humility, unless you have a serious psychological complex. But when we compare ourselves to God, that's always going to result in humility. And the last thing that we need to slide in there, though, is a realization of what God's all about, that grace, that love. So comparing ourselves to God will make us very humble. But when we realize God's grace and God's love and the sacrifice of Jesus, we will have feelings of worth. In other words, God thought we were worth the price of his son. So we come in humility, but we also know that we are worth the cost of his son's life. All right. Hopefully that explains that enough. In the taking it home section, we really can go two ways in this section. It's kind of based on how well you know your group and what you think your group might need to take that next step in faith. One thing that we want to do is to look at self-righteous people. We want to see the impact that self-righteousness has. It can be a tremendous barrier to faith because people feel put down or put off. They don't want any part of that. It's not attractional. It's not invitational. So for your group purposes, you can go two routes with this realization of self-righteous people. One is you can generalize it. Just pick out points that help people to see where self-righteousness can be that barrier to faith. Just identify some concepts. If you want to take it one step further, though, you can personalize that. And if you know your group well and you think they'd respond, I would encourage you to at least explore that option. By personalize it, I could see a line of questioning that would go like this. First, I would generalize. I would say, what kinds of things have you observed? Why was that a turnoff? How did that put people off? So you've generalized it. The next phase or line of questioning, I could see questions like this. Where do you see that today in our world? And then getting more and more narrow. Just think like a funnel. Where do you see that in our world? Where do you see that in the modern church? Where do you see that in WordServe? Where do you see that in yourself? So what we're doing is we're slowly bringing in that circle, like a little funnel, to laser focus on finally ourselves. And if you do this right, don't do that backwards, because if you focus on self first, you won't get those general concepts out there, and it won't be as impactful, I think, if you do it that way. So go big to small, go general to personal, and see if there is any part of that that exists in us. Because if so, here's a great opportunity to shed that, to become that more attractional, more invitational person. All right, so the last thing I will throw out here in this definition of the proper balance between humility and worth, let the group experiment with that idea of what is that proper balance. But you might consider this as a kind of a hip pocket plan if the discussion dies, or if you want to toss out this point. If you're thinking like a balance, think of the fulcrum, the thing on which like the seesaw sits and goes back and forth. You might consider grace as a fulcrum here. And let me explain what I mean. On the one hand, grace allows us the realization that there is not a thing that we can do to be justified before God. That can make us humble. The grace takes away our effort, takes away how smart we are, how much we know the Bible, any of that stuff. It makes us humble. On the other hand, that grace was extended because God thought we were worth that sacrifice. So, in effect, grace becomes a fulcrum by which we balance our worth and our humility. See if that resonates, or see if you can come up with other word pictures. I always love it when people can put analogies together like that. All right, as an aside, I'll just throw out that last question where it talks about what's a good definition of humility. It's kind of just a conversational question if you run out of time, but it gives me the opportunity to share one of my favorite definitions of humility. I can't remember who said this, but I heard this once. Humble people don't think less of themselves, they just think of themselves less. I don't know why that stuck with me, but I love that definition. All right, so to conclude this lesson, just to realize, we have only three sessions left. So I want to talk for just a second on how we finish the group well. I want to do that by asking you some questions. First question, what will your group look like next fall? Is there a different leader? Is there a different host? Are there two groups where there used to be one? Second question, is your group prepared for that? Do they know that you're planning on leaving? Or do they know that they're planning on being two groups instead of one? Do they know they may be meeting somewhere else? You might begin preparing them for that. And speaking of preparing, the third question is, what can you do to prepare your group for whatever that looks like in the future? Perhaps it's apprenticing. Perhaps it's inviting someone to take on a role that they currently don't have. The next question is, we've already talked about, but what will you, or how will you all be available during the summer? Do you want to continue to have people call, or to discuss, or to meet on an individual basis? Again, no requirement or expectation on my part, just laying it out there in case there are questions. So All of these things, as we approach the home stretch, are good questions to ask. They also remind me of one of my favorite verses out of Galatians, Galatians 6:9, which says, "Let's not get tired of doing what is good. And at just the right time, we will reap a harvest of blessing if we don't give up." So hey, don't give up out there. We will be there to see, I hope, a great harvest in the Fulshear area, in the West Katy area. And it's all based on what you do day in and day out. So hang in there. You're in the home stretch. Keep up the great work. Be blessed, and then be a blessing to others, even in the face of the good, the bad, and the ugly.